Human Services Committee on Rural Health Policy will, well, we're not dealing with rural health, we're dealing with human services today. Okay, we'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 355, and welcome. And I know that it's kind of slippery and slidey out there for those of you who had to travel long distances, and I appreciate you being here so early on Monday morning. Okay, Robert Peterson, Peter Koser, and Jack Dempsey, would you please come up and testify?
Mr. Chair, could we have an explanation of the bill from our capable administrator first?
Go ahead, give us an explanation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 355 establishes an electronic prescription monitoring program by the State Board of Pharmacy for information reported by pharmacies with regard to the dispensing of prescription drugs, limits access to and use of reported information, and provides certain factions from civil liability action as it relates to the reporting or use of the information. Additionally, this bill creates a prescription monitoring program advisory commission, and it's declared an emergency and effective upon passage.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Who would like to go first?
thank you very much, Chairman Moore said, Vice Chair, and Senators. I speak in support of Senate Bill 355.
Identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Peter Kosek. I'm a physician that practices pain management in Eugene, Oregon.
Okay.
Medications used to treat chronic pain that can also cause accidental overdose, lethal drug interactions, and drug addiction. Deaths of Oregonians can be prevented by the implementation of the prescription drug monitoring program, Senate Bill 355. The need for this legislation requires historical perspective. In 1993, as part of obtaining my Oregon medical license, I was told in no uncertain terms by the Oregon Medical Board that prescribing strong opiates for pain would result in discipline against me and likely loss of my medical license. In 1995, the Intractable Pain Act made it legal to prescribe opiates for chronic pain. Since that time, prescriptions for opiate pain medications have increased between 5 and 10-fold, and these prescriptions have improved the quality of life for many, many Oregonians. Unfortunately, there's been a significant downside to these prescriptions. The recreational use of prescription drug medications, pain medications, has increased 100% in high school students, and deaths from unintentional overdose of pain medications are now common. Just last year in the Journal of the American Medical Society, publishing the results from 1 year evaluation of West Virginia deaths of unintentional pharmaceutical overdoses. They described 295 deaths in one single year. Of these deaths, 93 involved the use of prescription pain medications. And notably, over 40% of these deaths, the decedents were also taking benzodiazepines, which is to say a sedative, Schedule 4 medications, and that were contributory to their deaths. This drug abuse and the related deaths require this legislative action. The need for a prescription monitoring program is not unique to Oregon. As of November 2008, 38 other states also have implemented a prescription drug monitoring program. 11 states, including Oregon, are in the process of considering such legislation. Patients often provide incomplete lists of medications that they take, particularly sedatives such as Valium, are regularly underreported by patients. Unfortunately, this underreporting can result in toxicity of appropriately prescribed pain medications. And the prescription monitoring program would allow the detection of those medication uses. Physicians also have a role in limiting the diversion of prescription medications. These include techniques such as screening patients for risks of drug abuse, urine drug toxicology, and explain to patients that they have to be responsible about their storage of medications and their use of medications. Unfortunately, those techniques are inadequate for preventing doctor shopping and diversion of prescription drug medications to non-medical use. My colleagues have voiced a concern that the information in this database will be used to censor physicians' practices. an article in the Journal of Law, Medicine, and Ethics in 2003 investigated this by querying many medical boards across the nation. And they concluded that it does not appear that electronic data tracking mechanisms led to increased numbers of complaints, investigations, or disciplinary actions against physicians related to opioid prescribing practices. Today, prescribing controlled substances in the treatment of chronic pain is an accepted medical practice. This prescription monitoring program would assist physicians by improving the safety of opioid therapy, both for the patient under our care and for society at large. The Lane County Medical Society has given its support to this legislation, and I ask the Senate to take this critical step at improving the care and safety of patients in Oregon.
Thank you very much. Questions? Would you talk a little bit about the Pain Commission's requirement for education in dispensing pain medication?
The Pain Commission was given a legislative mandate to require medical education for physicians and all prescribing personnel, in fact, non-physicians, about pain management. This includes appropriate prescribing practices. The guidelines for prescribing are well laid out both by the required one-hour educational summary of all medical professionals in Oregon and also by the Oregon Medical Board. I think that this made a relatively clear standard for the prescribing of controlled substances.
Okay. Good. Thank you very much, Dr. Kosick. Thank you.
Thank you, Senators, for allowing me here again today. I'm Dr. Robert Peterson. I'm the medical director of a federally qualified health center in Astoria. We take care of the uninsured, the underinsured, and Medicaid patients for the county of about 35,000 people. We have a significant problem with prescription drug abuse and diversion in our county. I often joke that it's probably replaced the fishing and the logging industry as the main industry in the county as our economy has suffered. My background is kind of varied. I started out as a medical oncologist, as a physician. I was hospice medical director for many years. I then joined the Air Force and was a flight surgeon for about 9 years. And I've been practicing primary care internal medicine here in this state for the past 3 years. So I think I have a fairly broad background in the use of pain medications, both from a specialty area and as a primary care physician. And that gives me a unique viewpoint to look at things. This bill is part of a program that would allow us to more safely prescribe and control dangerous but very necessary substances for treating patients who have pain, whether it's an acute pain problem or a chronic pain problem. Right now, unfortunately, this particular aspect of our approach to dealing with patients with pain is shackled in a 20th century approach. If I have a patient approaching me in the office with the complaint of chronic pain and he wishes or she wishes a refill of medication, I've never seen the patient before, I've seen the patient for several years. If I want to find out if they've been giving the same story to somebody else, I have to have one of my office staff, who's pretty busy doing a lot of other things, get on the phone and call every pharmacy that we can think of in a 50-mile range and ask them if they fill any prescriptions for this patient. It's surprising the number of times when I am slightly suspicious about this that we find that these folks have been receiving prescribed substances from various places. Unfortunately, I usually find this out after they've left the office, because as you can imagine, it takes a while to make these phone calls, to get replied faxes from the pharmacies that we've called, and then put that all together. So for the most part, if I see somebody that I don't know anything about and I've never seen before, even if they look like they have a legitimate problem, even if they have an objective problem that might be appropriate for them to be on narcotics, I'm reticent to prescribe them for them in long term because I have no way of knowing the veracity of their situation. With a 21st century approach that many states have taken, where there is a secure but web-based form of searching the prescription patterns for folks, it's a whole different story, and we can determine this right away, whether somebody's legitimate or not. That makes a big difference in how the patient feels I'm approaching them and how I feel I'm approaching the patient. I think in the past we've had patients come here who've been for this program just for that reason. Coming, if you lose your pills or whatever happens, you're traveling out of state and you're delayed, and you want to seek care on a Friday night, it's going to be pretty hard and tough to find anybody that's going to help you out without some way of actually knowing whether you're telling them a real story or not. In the past, when we're calling around, basically my office calls the pharmacy. The pharmacy will fax back something to us. They know our fax number. They trust our voice over the phone. But that's about it for secure identification of who's getting the information about the prescribed practices for the patient. In the web-based systems, there's a very much more significant level of security. You need to know passwords, usernames, IP addresses can be monitored. So they know, folks know who's requesting the information, logging when it's been requested, and logging where it's going to come back. It's actually a much more secure method of handling this information, which is legally available to prescribers and pharmacies, and has been for a long time. If we have a system that works, it will provide us several levels of positive things. First of all, it's going to protect the patients. It's difficult to think of having to protect somebody from themselves, but time and time again, you'll hear stories from folks that have become addicted to prescription medications that well-meaning friends, well-meaning physicians started them out down the road of using the medications, and they pretty soon were doctor shopping or buying the drugs or receiving the drugs from other friends. And if they had had a higher level of protection, it would have been harder for this to happen to them. It will help protect the provider from dealing with patients that are trying to fool them so that they can obtain medications illegally. We can protect pharmacies, not just from dealing with patients like this, but pharmacy supplies. Right now, in the past month, there's been a huge oxycodone deficiency in the country, and some of it's related to the fact that there's such a high abuse and diversion of oxycodone in the country. If we could cut down on the abuse and diversion, the actual supply for legitimate folks might be a little bit better. I've got patients who've been controlled on oxycodone for years, and now we're having to shift to less effective medications or medications with more side effects while we're waiting for the pharmacies to come up with the right amount of medication. A huge amount of money goes to evaluating and monitoring patients who actually don't have the problem that they're asking for opioids for. It's easier to identify these people in the emergency room or in the doctor's office, then we can save ourselves a lot of time and the insurance companies and the state a lot of money in unnecessary x-rays, lab tests, and whatnot, because now we've identified this person's been shopping around five different places for opioids in the past 2 days. That puts a different spin on their complaint of back pain. Maybe they don't need an MRI or an x-ray of their back. But it also protects society. The folks that are abusing these medications take a toll not on themselves, only on themselves, but the rest of us. In our county, at least, because I find myself on a first-name basis with a medical examiner, a large part because of the drug abuse and diversion problem we have in our county, there are a number of innocent victims. A lot of these are from motor vehicle accidents, and we've had a number of motor vehicle accidents fatal for not the driver but for the other car they hit in our county in just the past few years, where the driver, there were a couple empty pill bottles, all different prescription bottles from different people in the car, as well as a patch of fentanyl here and other drugs in their system. folks that are driving under the influence aren't always driving under alcohol influence. This is a serious problem. If we have one additional tool, which this is one, to help us address it, it will help a lot in protecting all of these areas of our state. Right now, we're surrounded by states that have similar programs already enacted, and it's a magnet for folks that want to abuse the system because they know they can get away with it here, and they can't, like they can in California, like they cannot be in California and Idaho, and now soon in Washington as their program ramps up. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Now, you're, again, practicing in Astoria, right?
Yes.
You have a clinic, a series of clinics?
There's one clinic there. We serve about 3,000 patients right now.
Okay.
I have two nurse practitioners also working in the clinic. We variably have between 3 and 6 practitioners in our clinic, depending upon who we can get to come out there to work.
Okay. And you no doubt have people on vacation who forgot their prescriptions, right? And come to you.
That's what they say sometimes.
And, and want you to write prescriptions for them. Okay? I think that's more common along the coast, probably.
Yes, yes. But a number of these tend to also be people that have just moved to the area.
Mm-hmm.
But I've had people who've just moved here come all the way down from below Tillamook to come to my clinic.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to the wonder of electronic records, in one such case, the person had stopped at the urgent care run by the hospital and then come to us for a second prescription, and I was able to get a hold of it's very easy for me to scan the hospital records, and I was able to see the person had just been seen in urgent care, which they denied when they came to our clinic, so we were able to catch them that way. And I had the police come and haul her away. But that's the exception rather than the rule for what happens with trying to deal with these folks.
Now, does law enforcement still pester you?
For what?
Well, for prescribing these types of drugs. I know that various physicians have entrapment law enforcement people come along once in a while and try to get them to write a...
Well, I know when I lived and worked in another state in Michigan, there was one physician who had to deal with a problem like that, but I believe it's more of that was almost 20 years ago.
Okay.
And I believe perception and use of this is much more feared than reality.
Okay.
I think that, there is a connection probably between the use of the illegal use of prescription drugs and the illegal use of other drugs. I know in all of the busts that hit the paper in our county, besides cocaine, marijuana, meth, and whatnot, there's always a supply of prescription medications. And I suspect from at least talking with my patients and what I see talking with local law enforcement that prescription medications become not only an abusable substance, but a form of barter for other illegal substances.
Okay. Good. Thank you very much. Questions? Okay. Thank you.
Hi, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. My name is Jack Dempsey. I'm with the Oregon Nurses Association. Here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 355 on behalf of Pam DeVisser, who's chair of the Nurse Practitioners of Oregon. You should have her testimony in front of you there. Advanced practice nurses in Oregon have some of the broadest prescription dispensing rights in the country, and as such, they are on the front lines of this issue along with physicians and pharmacists. We believe that the program set out in Senate Bill 355 will go a long way in stopping some of the widespread abuses going on throughout Oregon. Part of her testimony that stands out to me is obviously nurse practitioners have a close relationship with their patients, and she reports that a number of her patients have felt like criminals or second-class citizens when they've gone in to fill legitimate prescriptions. So as such, they just feel that this database will go a long way to making sure that the right prescriptions get to the right folks in a positive way and then go to stop a number of the abuses going on. So I'll let you read her testimony and answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you. Questions, comments? Okay. Thank you very much. Oh, yes.
I'm sorry. I forgot one point that I think is
Identify yourself again.
If I may?
Sir. Yeah, identify yourself again.
This is again Dr. Robert Peterson. This is a very important anecdote, I think, though. Recently, another rural health clinic just upriver from us in Clatskanie closed, and it was serving about 1,000 or more patients in that area. And a number of those patients have wanted to come to our clinic. We're already fairly overwhelmed with demand based on the number of providers we have available to us. A significant proportion of those patients, hundreds of them, were receiving opioids chronically for chronic pain diagnoses. Because we don't have the resources to check 300 different patients' prescriptions by hand in various pharmacies, I've declined to accept these patients into our practice because I don't know how to weed them out otherwise. I know that there's a small proportion of them are folks that we've actually fired out of our practice previously for abuse. But I don't know about the rest. And with our limited resources, I had to make the very difficult decision to not accept these patients into our practice. It would take too much time away from our ability to care for other patients with other problems. And this is a significant problem. I don't feel good about it, and I don't think the 300 or so patients who had to scramble around trying to find physicians who would prescribe for them in their area feel very good about it either. If we had protection such as what this Senate bill would offer, that would not be as much an issue for me for taking on patients like that. But to take a huge amount on at once was too much for us to be able to manage.
Okay.
Thank you for allowing me to insert my...
Okay, good. Thank you very much. Jody Pettit and Chris Apgar, would you come up, please?
Senator Morissette and members of the committee. I'm Jody Pettit. I'm a board-certified internist practicing in Portland for about 13 years. I currently see patients and teach residents at both Providence and Legacy Health Systems in their internal medicine residency training programs. In addition, I've cared for people at Multnomah County Health Department's West Side Clinic. I've seen innumerable people with pain, anxiety, grief, and insomnia. I come to you today with physician experience, but also from another vantage point. I have served as the Health Information Technology Coordinator for the State of Oregon through the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research. And in that capacity, I was also the Project Director of Oregon's Health Information Security and Privacy Collaboration, or HISPIC. The Oregon HISPIC project is a federally funded project to raise our privacy literacy. The project has been ongoing for the past several years and has developed and implemented a plan that includes consumer outreach and education. Much of what we've learned has a direct bearing on this issue because obviously prescription data is health information. I'm not here representing any of the above-mentioned organizations, but just myself as a private citizen. Let me say first and foremost that I don't see this issue in black and white. Whether to start a prescription monitoring program is a decision that really requires careful consideration. As is true for implementation of many information systems, we can see that it can be used to help people, but can also have the effect of hurting people as well. What is being weighed here today is whether the cost of this system in both money and the loss of personal privacy is worth the additional information that it could provide to catch a few with serious addiction or those who may be selling their medication for money. I have several points of concern. There is no consumer representation on the commission. A savvy person, preferably with healthcare and or legal knowledge, should be included with the intent of bringing a consumer perspective. Also, the Markle Foundation Connecting for Health Common Framework consumer survey showed us that people don't trust the government to hold their health information. only 13% expressed trust in the government to hold their medical data. Privacy experts agree that 87%, that's 87% of privacy breaches are by those people authorized to use the system. Creating a new system with broad access, i.e. tens of thousands of users around Oregon and others outside the state, exposes all Oregonians to this known risk. If this surveillance program did come into being, it should be completely transparent to people what data is being collected and how it will be used. There would need to be signs in clinics, hospitals, and pharmacies. There would need to be notices that should be read, understood, acknowledged by the person. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has put forth a new label called the Privacy Facts at a Glance, and that clearly shows people the privacy practices of organizations. A prescription monitoring program should be explained in a prominent manner on that label, in that label. Prescribers would need to be completely forthright with each and every person about where their prescription information would be sent before writing the script. Furthermore, individuals about whom data is collected should be able to see their own records. Decisions will be made about their care on the basis of this data, and as such, they should have a right to see it, check it for accuracy, and there should be a mechanism for fixing errors. Audit trails should be used, and people should be able to see exactly who has accessed their data and when. An accounting of disclosure should be available for any individual that wants to see it, and a course of action should be available to that person and clearly outlined. New federal privacy regulations are expected, especially regarding patient consent, and the program would need to come into compliance with that. There are very important technical and security-related issues regarding how patient matching would be accomplished, such as use of a master patient index. The method of identity proofing is extremely important so that the person that logs into the system is who they say they are. Furthermore, the authentication system must also be robust. The media has been reporting on countless security breaches over the past several years. But most importantly, I want to express concern regarding the adverse effect this could have on the doctor-patient relationship, a relationship based on professionalism, trust, and the expectation of confidentiality. This could be damaged by a conduit to a statewide database. It could have the effect of inhibiting individuals from getting medication for relief of pain, anxiety, grief, and insomnia, especially when one of the options in the bill is to refer people to law enforcement. It could have the effect of inhibiting clinicians from prescribing medications that could help individuals suffering from pain, grief, anxiety, and insomnia. In conclusion, the magnitude of what is at risk for all Oregonians outweighs the potential benefit of an incremental mechanism to identify the vast minority of people in this state who may be selling their medications for money or who have developed an addiction to controlled substances that would have otherwise gone undetected by practitioners. In our current system, signs of addiction become apparent in relatively short order. Compelling research would need to demonstrate that such a system significantly enhances clinicians' ability to identify these individuals. Based on my years of experience in clinics serving well-insured, Medicaid beneficiaries, and uninsured, and my insight into health information privacy issues in this country, I urge you not to proceed with a prescription surveillance program. My greatest concern is that it interferes with the care of people by undermining the trust between the individual and the healthcare delivery system and increasing the reluctance, shame, and stigma that a person might feel in getting treatment for conditions as pervasive as anxiety, insomnia, and pain. We need to take the long view and think about the implications in the broader context of enabling a surveillance society. Let's do it thoughtfully, carefully, and for the greater good. There's a phrase that's often used in privacy circles: nothing about me without me. This monitoring program is an example of moving a person's health information without their consent, and if not implemented prominently and transparently, could be without their knowledge. Availability of health information can absolutely help us to have a safer, higher quality healthcare system. But let's put our energy into people having their own personal health records that are private and under their control. Let's help them get information to better understand their conditions, including medication dependence. In the words of the Healthy Oregon Act, using information that technology that is cost neutral or has a positive return investment to deliver efficient, safe, and quality health care and a voluntary program to provide every Oregonian with a personal electronic health record that is within the individual's control, use, and access that is portable. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Jody. Chris?
Hello, my name is Chris Apgar, and I appreciate you hearing my testimony. I am testifying in opposition to Senate Bill 355. A bit of background about myself. I've been working in the healthcare privacy and security arena for about a decade now. I work in the local Northwest as well as nationally and internationally. One of the big portions of my business is to conduct privacy and security audits of health plans, providers, and any other organization dealing with healthcare information. I also served with Jody on the HSPIC project in Oregon as the technical advisor to that project. I serve on the National Advisory Board to the project. I chair the Oregon and Southwest Washington Healthcare Privacy and Security Forum, and I'm also a member of the Board of Directors for the Work Group for Electronic Data Interchange, which is a national organization statutorily defined as an advisory body to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services on privacy and security and anything else relating to HIPAA. So just as a background, that's where I'm coming from as a privacy and security professional. There are two key reasons why I oppose this particular measure. And what I have done to help the committee, because I know that you get lots of paperwork, is I bulleted the key points that I would like to cover on the first page, and then there's background if you're interested in reading it. One of the issues that I see with this particular bill that needs to be addressed and needs to be addressed up front is if this group moves forward, then the Oregon legislature needs to make the commitment to, in essence, shell out the dollars to create the appropriate system. We're looking at a system that, by bill language, needs to be a 24/7 system. That costs money. The cost of such a system in Kentucky was over $1 million. And I look at this also in comparison with the Oregon Health Record Bank, which is a project being undertaken by the Oregon Department of Human Services. It's a CMS grant for creating what amounts to personal health records for Medicaid beneficiaries. Much smaller group of individuals that will be impacted. The cost, the price tag for that just implemented is $5 million. I also anticipate an ongoing cost of approximately $1 million or more per biennium, because I'm looking at this from a holistic perspective. In the privacy and security world, if I'm to set up a system that is private and secure, I need to do things like control the access to who can get into that system, what can they see. I need to make sure that when they are no longer in that position, that they can no longer have that access. I need to audit who has access to that, both from an ongoing, when I see an audit log pop up that says so-and-so accessed the system, I need to look at that. I also need to look at it, say, on an annual basis to say, is this working? Are the privacy and security controls in place? I need to conduct a risk analysis to say that I'm going to look at the whole system. I'm going to say, what are the things that can threaten it? And do I have the appropriate controls in place to protect that? This is not free. If it's a web-based type of an approach. I remember, as an aside, I recently received an email from the chair, the executive director of the Oregon Pain Commission, who is setting up a secure website, and asked me some questions about setting up a secure website. And I provided him advice on, just because you have that little wonderful key in the corner of your web page does not mean it's secure, and a few other things. So it's, for me, when I'm looking at it in two perspectives, one, in my opinion, if this is to go forward, it needs to have a significant amount of dollars associated with it so that it's done right. I have similar concerns from a privacy and security perspective as Dr. Pettit. As some people say, privacy and security professionals can tend to be paranoid. But I'm also a patient. I also have chronic conditions. I also have medications that would be tracked in the system. And as an aside, they are not opiates, but they would be tracked. I have some concerns about my own privacy and security, let alone the privacy and security of Oregonians whose information will be stored in this system. There really do need to be some very strong privacy and security controls around this if it is to be put up and running, because otherwise you endanger the privacy and security of all Oregonians who are receiving, say, benzodiazepines as an example, which is for generally prescribed for a mental health condition such as post-traumatic stress disorder. I also have concerns about the lack of enforcement and penalties actually in the law itself. To be effective, I don't think that leaving it up to the pharmacy board to create rules is appropriate. I believe that if this does go forward, there needs to be some strong enforcement, and also there need to be strong penalties, and that may even include criminal penalties for misuse of the information. Because thinking about it, I'm in a small practice, I'm a doctor, I'm very busy. So I may not be the one who's accessing this database. I'll turn my password and such over to, say, the office manager, who's going to go, hey, look, that's my neighbor. That's pretty interesting information. Is this a story? No. This happens every day. And, in fact, there is a medium-sized healthcare delivery system in Oregon that they have moved to the point where if they find anybody accessing information inappropriately, looking up their neighbor and such, they are terminated on the spot. If a provider accesses the information inappropriately, all of their access is terminated on the spot. Those are some of the things that need to be in there and need to be enforced. Otherwise, I believe that this is ripe for abuse by other individuals. I also agree with Jody Pettit's figure on where privacy and security breaches occur. One of the things I like to emphasize when talking to people and providing training about security is a lot of us think about security as the little technical geeks that are sitting over in the corner, whereas 87% of the breaches do not occur because of a technology glitch, because of a hacker. They occur because people inside an organization, either in a malicious fashion or through, it's not necessarily on purpose, but information is disclosed that should not be. When I go into an organization and audit it, I don't care the size of the organization. I have audited organizations that are multi-state. I have audited small practices, not-for-profits. And in every single case, I have found significant security issues that have not and are not being addressed. And that's one of the things that I do advise my clients on. What do you need to do to make sure that that information is not inappropriately disclosed? An example in Oregon to look to is Providence Health System's the security breach that disclosed 365,000 records of home health patients in Oregon. That is significant. And that occurred because the appropriate privacy, or excuse me, security practices were not being adhered to. Move on. I would like to make the committee aware that there are more issues than just HIPAA out there from a legal perspective. I think that the committee needs to take into account what is already existing Oregon law. As an example, I had mentioned benzodiazepines before. That, in a lot of respects, identifies that individual as someone with a mental illness. Well, Oregon law protects that and specifically indicates that if that information is going to be disclosed and the patient needs to have the ability to sign an authorization. On the federal side, as well as the state side, if you're dealing with alcohol and chemical dependency and you're releasing information such as the person is on methadone for opiate addiction treatment, then that information needs to be, under Oregon and federal law, the individual it's required that they get or they have the ability to sign an authorization saying, yes, it's okay to release. Another thing about 42 CFR Part 2, which is the Federal Alcohol and Chemical Dependency Regulation, and HIPAA, is that the disclosure to law enforcement is very strictly limited. It is very defined. And under 42 CFR Part 2, a law enforcement officer cannot walk into, say, a clinic and say, I want this information about this individual with a subpoena or with a warrant. They have to have what's called a qualified court order. which says that that information will be used only for that particular legal activity, and it will be destroyed after that. That's not accounted for. And in fact, there is language in this particular bill that leaves it up to the Board of Pharmacy to say, hey, I can give this to law enforcement because. Yes, there is language that says this is pursuant to drug enforcement activity on the part of law enforcement, but there's also additional language that leaves it open to release to law enforcement for other reasons, which would be in violation of HIPAA. It would also likely be in violation of 42 CFR Part 2. So what we're looking at here is, from my perspective, there's a significant fiscal impact that needs to be addressed in order to do this properly. There need to be the appropriate privacy and security practices and procedures and technology implemented in order to make sure that this works and people's information is protected. There needs to be education, both of those people using the system and not using the system. All of this, as far as security, privacy, and so forth, needs to stretch beyond the Board of Pharmacy or whoever is responsible for maintaining this. It is as secure as the weakest link. It is as secure as that pharmacy out in Coos Bay, or over in Madras, or out in John Day, or the provider's office in Milton Freewater. It has to be secure at all levels. Otherwise, you are opening yourself for breach. So I have some grave concerns about privacy and security and the ability of the state to perform those functions. The state itself has also experienced privacy and security breaches. I also am concerned about the fact that in looking at the language on the face of it, there are some areas that do need to be addressed if this is to move forward that create a legal liability to the state, create conflicting statute, and opens up the state to legal action and challenges because the bill conflicts either with existing state law or it conflicts with federal law. And as an aside, in the reference in the bill, it references the, in essence, the privacy and security language in HIPAA. It does not address an overarching issue that should be taken into account, and that is that HIPAA allows for state law to preempt HIPAA, but it only allows it generally without going to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and asking permission if it's more stringent. In other words, it allows the patient greater access to their information or provides greater protections. This falls in the area of where I have to go ask permission of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services before I can implement such an effort. It is specifically outlined or specifically addressed in 45 CFR 160.203, where it specifically states that, yes, the state can implement a monitoring program, but only if they have the permission of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And to me, that is something that should be included as language in the bill to put, in essence, the pharmacy board on notice that before you go out and start collecting data, you better have your ducks in a row and ask for permission. So in conclusion, my opposition is primarily focused on concerns about privacy and security and the cost related to that, and also the ability to put in place privacy and security at all levels, not just at the monitoring, where the monitoring database sits, but throughout Oregon in practices, pharmacies, and so forth. And also I have concerns about conflicts with existing state and federal law. Thank you very much for your time. Any questions?
Thank you. Yes. Senator Montes Anderson.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much for coming, and you brought up some very, I think, important issues. We do want to make this bill a better bill, and if you had proposed amendments and if we address the patient consent piece, the consumer, adding a consumer onto the advisory board, setting up education, setting up safeguards, would you be more, and penalties, would you be more amenable to this bill, or do you just want it to go away entirely?
So, Chair Morris, that Senator Montes Anderson, I'm not saying that this, and I think, and Dr. Pettit can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think that the issue here is that improving the quality of health through different measures, which this may be one of them, is something that's opposed. It's that there needs to be some great thought and planning given to it, and all of the areas such as have been brought up need to be addressed, such as paying for it, making sure that there's privacy and security at all levels, making sure that it's transparent, making sure there's a consumer on the board. One of the other issues that I saw when I was looking through the language is it said the person from the Department of Human Services needed to be a addiction specialist. What happened to the pain management side of things? I think that that should also be included. So do I outright say that this concept is something that should go away altogether? No, I'm not saying that. What I am saying, though, is that I think there needs to be some very careful thought given to what is being proposed and making sure that the bill, if it ever does go forward, or this does go forward, that it that things are being addressed, such as privacy, security, patient consent, and so forth.
May I also answer that question? After giving this literally years of consideration, and from what I've learned through being involved at a national level in privacy and security endeavors, I would have to say that although there's gray and although there is potential for benefit in a system such as this, I would still have to say that I would urge you not to go forward with it. I think what it represents in terms of movement towards greater surveillance of people for lawful activity, for healthcare, and for something that's supposed to have a very confidential nature, I just think it's movement in a disturbing direction. I think it leaves people that are vulnerable with really nowhere to go to get care. So people have to, when they come in the exam room and meet with their physician, clinician, they have to feel that they can be open and honest. And if we set up a situation where there's a possibility that they'll be referred to law enforcement, I think that changes the equation. It's not an easy subject, and when I was a third-year resident, I thought this would be a great idea. I thought the pharmacies should all hook up so we could catch these people. But as I get older and have a little more experience, I don't feel that way anymore. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ariva Figman. And Sharon Merriman.
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, my name is Sharon Myron. I reside in Portland, Oregon. I am a practicing emergency physician there at Portland Adventist Medical Center, and I'm here both on behalf of myself and also the Oregon College of Emergency Physicians in strong support of this bill. Go to medical school, and the first thing we learn, like the first day of medical school, is do no harm. I think the vast majority of us go into medicine so that we can help people and improve lives. One of the most frequent complaints that we see in the emergency department every single day is pain. One of our most difficult tasks is differentiating, is evaluating the pain and treating the pain. It's a very difficult process to do, and it's become increasingly difficult for us because there has been a fairly disturbing and increasing trend in the number of patients who present seeking narcotic pain medicine either for diversion or for their own personal abusive purposes and not for actual treatment of pain. I think that this type of activity is draining to the system as a whole. It drains resources. It erodes the doctor-patient relationship. and it makes it very difficult to care for people when you just don't know. In the practice that I engage in, it's not every so often we see this or suspect this. It's multiple times every single day, every shift, every week, every year. I think that the bill and the prescription monitoring program would significantly enhance safety both on an individual level and on a societal level. For individuals, I think the danger of doctor shopping and using these narcotic pain medications is a couple of things. There's the potential for overdose, either intentional or accidental. When that happens, we often see these patients and they're in critical condition. We can't obtain a history. We don't know what they may have taken. And we're juggling multiple other patients as well. When we're lucky, we can, at the same time as managing the patient, figure out what they may have taken, how much they may have taken, to direct our care. Programs such as this would help us do that effectively and efficiently and help treat the patient. I think on a societal level, the problem is, I think there's overwhelming evidence of the problem of diversion of these medications and increasing use among teenagers, which is extremely disturbing. And epidemiologically, the increase in the number of overdoses from these types of medication is it's drastically increasing, and this is a significant danger that I think having a program like this would help us in the front lines in the ER be able to address in a timely and appropriate manner. In addition to public health and safety, which is of paramount importance, there's also the question of cost to society of this sort of doctor shopping, they call it. Vast majority of these patients aren't able to pay their doctor bills. They don't pay their ambulance bills. They don't pay their ER visit bills. They don't pay their medication bills, except for the narcotic medications. I've seen numbers of patients who come in, they have pain, you know, maybe there's a urinary tract infection. I give the benefit of the doubt. I'll prescribe an antibiotic and some narcotic pain medicine, and I get a call from the pharmacy saying, "Hi, doctor, the patient's trying to fill the prescription for the narcotic but not the antibiotic. Is that okay?" And it happens all the time. It's not an isolated thing. There's also repeated, extensive, costly workups for patients that have had, you know, multiple workups for the same condition. In addition to the monetary costs of this that are being borne by society, taxpayers, insurance companies, and hospitals, there is also an actual safety concern for the patients. Some of these tests are not benign. CAT scans have been increasingly shown to be linked to increased incidences of cancer later in life. And I see patients who have had 10, 20 more CAT scans on their abdomen because they go to different places and present with the same complaint. I think having a monitoring program like this will allow us to confront these patients and open up a discussion so that we can have the dialogue and address the situation in an appropriate way for them and for society. You know, in terms of the privacy issues, I totally understand that, and it would be of paramount importance to me to have strict security measures in place. I think what Senator Moniz Anderson mentioned earlier, if we're able to implement some of these safeguards, you know, I think that would be a benefit. But I think these privacy issues have also been out there in the 38 states that have implemented programs like this, and there has not actually been shown up till now to be an issue with the privacy. It should be studied, absolutely, but there has been a clear clear benefit to having the programs implemented in terms of drug diversion and drug abuse. And so I think that that far outweighs what is right now a theoretical privacy concern. Just two other quick things. Regarding cost, I think Kentucky was mentioned as one of the states with a $1 million implementation cost. I believe Kentucky, I'm not sure, so, but I believe Kentucky was one of the first programs, and I think that over time, and now that so many states have implemented these programs, the initiation costs have substantially decreased, and I know in states like in Illinois, I think the operating cost per year is $250,000 a year. From just a personal emergency medicine physician perspective, it really affects our morale day to day, hour to hour. It makes us cynical. Makes me cynical. It makes me suspicious. I consider myself an empathic, caring person, and it makes me feel like I'm a bad doctor because I just don't have the kind of trust in patients that I should. We're able to find out this information currently to some degree, but it takes a tremendous amount of time. It's tedious. It's frustrating. We're calling pharmacies when we have multiple patients to see and take care of. And I think what a gentleman said earlier, that these safeguards in place with a prescription monitoring program are actually better than what's currently out there with me calling Joe the pharmacist and saying, hi, it's Sharon from Adventist. I have this patient here. What are their prescriptions? And that is what happens currently. I'm very in support of this, and I speak for many of my colleagues. I brought a number of emergency medicine physicians with me to speak on this, but I really appreciate your time. Do you have any questions?
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay.
Senator Bates.
Go ahead.
Senators, my name is Aviva Zygmunt, and I am also an emergency medicine doctor. I've been one for 12 years, and I also work with Sharon at Portland Adventist, which is one of the busiest emergency departments in the Portland metro area. Over the last 12 years, I've seen a dramatic shift from illegal drug addictions to prescription drug addiction, and many people that are not in the medical field are wondering how this can happen. It seems like it would be such an easy epidemic to control compared to crystal meth or heroin, which is made illegally. Why are so many doctors prescribing so many patients narcotics that they don't need? One of the most important ethical jobs as a physician is to alleviate pain and suffering, and often this is all we can do in the face of some injuries and terminal problems. It is extremely difficult to tell if someone is in true pain or not, and frankly, I would rather treat 4 drug addicts than to miss that one person that is having true pain. The emergency department is on the front line of prescription narcotic abuse. We're usually busiest after hours and on weekends when clinics are closed and medical records are difficult to access. One of the most important tools we use to identify abusers is by calling pharmacies for the prescription lists, calling other emergency departments, clinics, and hospitals, trying to piece together a patient's narcotic use that they're not honest about. This is very time-consuming, aggravating, and done while we are trying to take care of critically ill patients that need our undivided attention, and while other patients are waiting in the waiting room, sick, vomiting, and in true pain. Discovering a narcotic abuser is satisfying in many ways. They're confronted about clogging up the emergency department, giving false addresses so that they don't have to pay their bills, and masking true disorders such as anxiety, depression, or abuse. These patients often blame the physician for making them addicted, and there are cases where we physicians are being held liable for patients' behavior when they are under the influence of narcotics. The scope of people harmed by these incredibly addictive drugs goes far beyond the abuser. My everyday goal is to deliver appropriate, compassionate care. I have multiple personally challenging cases on a daily basis. Just over the weekend, a 33-year-old woman with severe degenerative back disease had to wait hours until I could get in touch with her regular doctor to know that she was legitimately using narcotics. A teenager and her boyfriend that snickered, "That's all it took," as they walked out with their Vicodin prescription for severe dental pain. I try not to walk into every patient's room in the defensive mode, pitting their ability to manipulate me against my tools to find out if they are truly seeking. Having an online prescription registry can help us quickly identify the patients that are abusing the system and not being upfront about their dependence. These patients are keeping you, your family, and all Oregonians from getting the quick, compassionate care, which is what you deserve in a true emergency. Any questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Alan Bates, would you come up, please? Senator Alan Bates.
Either one works.
Either one works.
Or both.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Alan Bates, State Senator from Southern Oregon, also a still practicing physician. Committee members, I'll make my comments very short today. You've heard all this before. I just want to go over a couple things real quickly, and then I want to speak to the bill a little bit, if I could, just for a few moments. This is a bill that is far overdue. We probably should have had this before this time, and you've heard testimony about it already today. I'll give you three quick stories from my practice that hopefully will help you focus on this. Last fall, I went to a seminar on pain control. And one of the things they told us is whenever you have a pain patient with you, always get a urine test on them. And my reaction was, well, why would you get a urine test? They're going to test positive. He's on a pain medication. And they told us about 10% of the time they test negative. People aren't getting it. They're getting it from you and selling it. And it sort of had me set back on my feet and think about that for a minute. And we've done some testing in our office. It's about 1 in 10. And I was surprised to find that out. So that was something from my own practice also. The other class of patients I'm concerned about are people who are getting narcotics and benzodiazepines from various physicians, and we don't know if they're getting it from different people, and they're using them legitimately individually, not realizing that the combination of drugs often leads to hospitalizations, ER visits, confusion. And what I usually have happen in my practice is I get a phone call from a relative or family member saying, "Mom or Dad or my brother just aren't acting right. They seem confused. They're always sleeping." And we finally find out ultimately by having the family bring every prescription bottle they can find into the office that they're getting drugs from different physicians. And we're actually not realizing they're getting themselves in trouble, especially a problem for elderly patients. And I'll tell you one last story that happened to me also. About 5 or 6 years ago, a couple of us physicians were getting together and talking, and we started talking about migraine patients we had and how we were dealing with them. And we found out we were all talking about the same patient. And this is a very nice lady, about 55 years of age, presented very well at the office. I saw her about every 2 or 3 months to give her medication, trying to prevent migraines, and a little bit of a Vicodin prescription for backup. We found out, ultimately, that she lived in Reno, Nevada, and was working in the I-5 corridor. And when the police finally picked her up, her notes of the records of her office visits were better than mine. She was seeing 30 or 40 doctors up and down the I-5 corridor, taking medication back to Reno and selling it. And I would tell you, that's probably not as uncommon as we might think. I was actually pretty impressed by her progress notes. They were really very good. Probably better than mine. But she had all these doctors, and she had to keep perfect notes because she couldn't remember what she said to each of them after she saw them. So it really is a problem. Senate Bill 355, I think, is an excellent bill. It needs our support. I would tell you there's some issues in it that I think still need to be resolved, and I'm sure we can do that through this process. How we're going to set the system up, how it's going to be paid for, some issues about interaction with physicians on it, and are all things that can be resolved. I don't think the way it's written is any problem, as far as I'm concerned, with patient confidentiality. I think this can be easily protected. We have other issues that are bigger in the bill than that we can take care of, but I just don't see it as a problem. And the system, while it may cost us some money to set up and run, and I think it will cost some money, and we have to be serious about this, remember, we're looking at a healthcare system that cost us $20 billion a year. $20 billion. This is about patient safety, a very small amount of money to make more patients safe and to stop the diversion of narcotics and benzodiazepines. So from my point of view, bill long overdue. I hope for your support, and I'm glad to work with the advocates to make some, I think, minor changes that will make it a much better bill. And I'd be glad to entertain any questions you might have.
Yes, Senator Mona Sanders.
Thank you. It was brought up in earlier testimony that there wasn't any consumer on the advisory board. We're sort of going in that way. Are you open to that, or do you have pros and or cons against that? And the other issue is an education piece and patient consent, wanting patient consent, although I can see people abusing that also. And people who are on medications that they truly don't want other people to know that they are on, and there we're getting into safeguards. So those were the three issues that sort of were in my mind. Could you respond just briefly?
Yes. Mr. Chair and Senator Mons Anderson, if I've got them correctly, first was board makeup.
Yeah.
That's one of the issues I think needs to be worked on, not only from the point of view that we need consumers on that, but there's some other parts that I think need to be tweaked. Not major problems, I think things we can come to an agreement on. So I think the board makeup is important and probably needs to be changed a little bit. An education piece, I assume that's directed at physicians, I'm guessing?
Yes.
I wasn't here for that part of the conversation.
And the patient.
And the patient?
Yes, okay. To know that their name is going into a database.
I have no problem with that, and I think it's probably a wise thing to do. Mr. Chair, the third question I think was about patient consent. Unfortunately, if you have patient consent, it kind of nullifies what you're trying to do here. It will take care of half the problem, and that I think the people who are misusing drugs inadvertently will be covered. But for diversion of drugs, these people are not going to ask for patient consent. So I would say that's something we really shouldn't be doing in this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Bates. And we've discussed this, and there will be amendments, and there are things we'll consider after this. But the other point I'd like to make, Senator, is if you'll see me on the floor, I think I can help you with your logistical problem of getting here from Southern Oregon, because I do it on a regular basis.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, may I respond to that? In the last 2 weeks, I've had three flights canceled on me, one of which actually made it to Portland but didn't land. I've now been banned from the Medford Airport. They think I'm the cause, and will not allow me on the airport grounds or near a plane. That's what I can say.
Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Chair. And I apologize, Dr. Bates. I missed the rest of your I missed your testimony. So if I'm asking a question that's been asked, forgive me. As a provider, one of the issues brought up was, and in my mind, thinking the fiscal impact at the provider level of having to implement security measures that would satisfy confidentiality issues. Do you see any substantial cost in relationship for providers to have to implement security measures on keeping the privacy of patients' information?
Mr. Chair and Senator Telfer, from a physician's point of view, it's not going to be burdensome or a cost. From a pharmacist's point of view, they're going to have to enter this into the registry in some way. With electronic medical records and electronic data keeping, I don't think that would be a huge problem. That question really should be directed to a pharmacist. From my point of view, as a physician and a provider, I think I can speak for the physicians, and hopefully I'm representative of them. No problem at all. We write our prescriptions, and we are required now when we write narcotic prescriptions to have a carbon copy immediately in the chart, or if it's an electronic record, do the same thing. We actually have special forms we use that can't be duplicated or changed, and I can bring you a copy so you could see that. They look kind of different than our other prescriptions. We write all our narcotic prescriptions on a completely different form now. It's required by Medicare, and we all use it for all of our narcotic prescriptions and for benzodiazepines. And it's just a better way to go. We keep a careful record of that.
Mr. Chair, follow-up question?
Yes.
In addition to that, the security from inappropriate use of other personnel in the office.
Mr. Chair, Senator Telfer, that is always a problem. We keep our records under lock and key, and most places do. When you have electronic medical record system, you put up pretty good firewalls. Can people break into that? Absolutely. Sooner or later, I suppose you could. Frankly, most people just don't care. But we have to, as an example, when we do records for sexually transmitted disease or doing HIV tests, we use a numerical system for it. We don't use the patient's name, and we try to make it as discreet and as safe as we can. This is a common problem. That's why we have the HIPAA records that we work under, and I think for the most part it's not a major problem. I have not heard of any major problem with confidentiality of records. We had an issue 2 years ago, I think, where a laptop was left out and a lot of records were made available. Those never became a problem. I think they just stole the laptop and destroyed the tapes or the hard drive. It's always a possibility. I wouldn't sit here and say it isn't, but we've done a really good job in the last 5 or 10 years to make records for patients very confidential, almost impossible to get to. In fact, when I'm there on weekends, I want to pull a record out, I can't do it. Okay, it's locked in a way that we have to have two people to get in and out. And, well, it's lots of reasons they won't let me do it, but that's another thing. They want to make sure they get the chart back. Yeah. And they don't trust me to refile it properly. But we're really tight about it, and we like to keep it that way. And I'm sure other officers are doing the same thing. Physicians are very aware of this, and they know how confidential these records are and how important they are to individual patients.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, yes. Just to follow up on Senator Bates, I mean, that's an issue, and it's how a doctor deals with it is going to be the same whether it's an electronic record or paper record. So it's the system itself, not the form of the record, that's the issue.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz couldn't agree more. Absolutely true.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for allowing me to testify. And I'll try to figure a better way to get up here. Thank you.
Kyle Miller, would you come up, please? Patrick Bratz. Oh, Karen. Here. No, I don't have an idea.
Good morning, Chair Morissette and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Addiction Programs Administrator for the Department of Human Services, Addictions and Mental Health Division. And I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 355. The division supports the policy included in the bill, but does not have, is neutral on the fiscal impact because it was not a policy included in the governor's budget. I'd like to say that the Board of Pharmacy and the Pharmacy Association have worked very hard with the division and with DHS to make improvements in the bill from last session. And we continue to have those discussions. Prescription drug abuse is a very serious problem in Oregon. According to the National Survey on Drug Use and Health, which is done every year, funded by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, 226,000 Oregonians have abused prescription drugs every year. Oregon ranks higher than the national average for all age categories for abuse of prescription drugs. And alarmingly to many of us in the addictions field, this is becoming a trend, an upward trend for youth. For youth ages 12 to 17, Oregon has an 8% rate of youth that are engaged in non-medical use of pain relievers, and nationally it's 7%. A growing concern about this is that youth don't typically perceive prescription drugs to be as dangerous as illicit drugs. And this is also true for young adults and older adults as well. They see this coming from a doctor, from a pharmacy, so it's not as dangerous. And as we know, these drugs can result in death, overdose poisoning. And leading into that, there's been a 100% increase in the rate of narcotic-associated poisoning deaths between 1999 and 2006, according to the Public Health Division Office of Disease Prevention and Epidemiology. As you've already heard, people who become addicted to prescription drugs do engage in doctor shopping and pharmacy shopping in order to avoid the confrontation. I'd like to say, and I haven't heard anybody talk about this yet today, that there are new tools that can be implemented in a primary care setting for doctors and others providing these healthcare services to intervene and provide brief interventions and discussions with patients about their prescription drug abuse, and frankly, alcohol and other drug abuse as well. And the Oregon Health and Science University is participating in a NIDA, National Institute on Drug Abuse, funded project to train residents in how to deliver these types of services and provide these interventions. And I think this would be an important tool, the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, as well as it's called ESPERT, Screening, Brief Intervention, and Referral to Treatment, to really address this issue in primary care. It could expand addiction services beyond traditional specialty addiction treatment into primary care settings. The division has three suggested amendments to the bill. As I pointed out, we have worked closely with the Board of Pharmacy and the Pharmacy Association on amendments, so these discussions have already taken place, but I'll, for the record, list these amendments. You've heard testimony about the confidentiality and some of the state and federal regulations regarding confidentiality that are not currently mentioned in the bill. So the first suggestion is for Section 3, Subsection 2D, and Section 5, Subsection 2A, we would suggest referencing two confidentiality laws in addition to HIPAA, that being 42 CFR Part 2, concerning confidentiality of alcohol and drug information, and ORS 179.515 through 179.525, concerning mental health records, because some of these medications will be mental health medications as well as addiction medications, which is actually a very growing research-based field in drug-assisted treatment for addictions. The second amendment is regarding clarification of the representation of DHS on the advisory committee, and I've already talked with the folks who are crafting the amendments about identifying the division responsible for administering addiction services in that category for DHS. And then the third requested amendment is to exempt pharmacies that are part of state institutions as defined in ORS 179.010. This amendment could be added as Section 5, and subsequent sections could be renumbered after that. And this amendment would exempt the state hospital and the Department of Corrections institutions, and this would reduce the fiscal impact of the bill as well. Just wrapping up, I want to thank you for this opportunity. I've been in the addictions field for 24 years, both as a clinician, a clinical supervisor working in a private nonprofit program. I have seen many, many people addicted to not only illicit drugs, alcohol, but prescription drugs. It's been frustrating for treatment providers as well as the folks you've heard from earlier today. This would provide a very useful tool, I believe, for Oregon. And I would be happy to be a resource to the committee and answer any questions you may have.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, just a Senator quick question. I understand number three, exempting Oregon State Hospital and Department of Corrections from the system. Sometimes they are put on, well, I won't go that route, but this would then be a mandate, though, to our county clinics. I know they don't, in an indirect way, they get general funds, but is that going to be a problem, do you foresee, for county clinics? And would they need to be a part of this system?
which I think they would.
Chair Morissette, Senator Montes-Anderson, if you are referring to the health clinics, public health clinics mm-hmm. of the county, yes, they would. If they operate pharmacies, they need to be a part of this, and physicians and healthcare practitioners that are part of those clinics would have access to the database.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you. I guess my going back to three again, I'm wondering, clearly when they're in the institution, I'm fully supportive of that, but what about if they're released with a prescription, should that be part of the system?
Chair Morissette and Senator Cruz, as I understand it, individuals who are released, I'm more familiar with the state hospital, mm-hmm. They're released with a limited supply of medications to get them through, and there's pretty tight management and coordination between the state hospital staff and the community staff who are going to take that patient. So I don't see that as a concern. I'm not as familiar with the Department of Corrections practices.
Yeah, Ms. Chair, I guess I wasn't looking at the state hospital. I was looking more at corrections because I know that it's pretty controlled on release from the state hospital, but corrections might be something we need to explore. I'm not wanting to get into their internal system, but clearly if somebody is released or paroled from DOC and they have prescriptions and they want continuity on the outside, having something go with them might be beneficial to them. So I don't want to throw a whole lot of roadblocks in this, but that when we're looking at these amendments, that's something we may want to have somebody from DOC in to inform us on. So
that's a good suggestion. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Kyle Miller.
Chairman Morissette, members of the committee, I am Kyle Miller. I'm the Chief Information Security Officer for the Department of Human Services. And I will be discussing information security as I would be reviewing this bill. As an information security professional, my responsibilities are to ensure the availability, the integrity, and the confidentiality of information. As I take a look at this bill, the things that we would do is to attempt to mitigate risk, transfer risk where we can, and accept risk. As was pointed out by Senator Cruz, this information is already out there. It just happens to be in paper format. So the risks that we're facing about people gaining access, as I listen to the testimonies already presented, are already there. People are gaining access to the information. They're just doing it either calling someone up, and we don't know who's on the other end, and they're still gaining the information. And so we're going through a process where we're still accessing it. Mine isn't on the specific system, but it's on the information itself. As I take a look at, I have some key concerns about any type of compliance that we need to meet. And those are those key concerns are in compliance, transportation of informational assets, business continuity and disaster recovery, identity management, and access control. As I review different sections, we, for compliance, we reference many places. We talked about HIPAA. We talked about the Identity Theft Protection Act. These are great pieces of compliance, but they may not get us the details of how we actually protect the information. If we procure systems, like the state of Washington did, we may want in the RFP to ensure that we reference other things like the payment card industry standards so that we can ensure that the network is set up appropriately. We may want to reference more as far as procedure-wise how we're going to handle access to information through items like the NIST 853 series. But those can be placed during an RFP or as the system's being developed. As we take a look at the transformation of electronic assets and of other media in the bill, it provides for information on both paper to be submitted. We need to take a look at how we're going to protect those information, that information in whatever category or whatever mechanisms we're going to transport it. I referenced in the presentation I provided, it's not just a technology issue. A lot of times people continue to focus on the technology, and yes, we can provide this information, and when there's a breach or something that has happened, more information can be readily available at one point, but that information is still available, usually in paper format or other media. As I take a look at the bill, it does talk about, as Mr. Apgar identified 24/7 access. Well, if our building goes down, this whole housing system, then we're going to lose this. So there's going to be a general additional cost in ensuring that if this system has to be up 24/7, that we make sure that there's mechanisms put in place to ensure that that availability is there. And that's not just for the systems themselves. All too often we focus on the technology piece, but we forget that we're going to have people present. And so our business continuity plans, when we're taking a look at this information, should also ensure that we have elements to ensure that our personnel are going to be available to have this information available to us. There's always a concern, especially in systems like this, and prior to my coming to the state, I worked for a hospital organization which had 20 hospitals and 90 clinics, is identity management and access control, which I think are probably the two most important pieces here. We have activities going on in the state, and we have activities throughout where we want to identify who individuals are. When someone calls, as I heard in some testimonies earlier, they're calling. We honestly do not know who they are on the other side. There are mechanisms in place that can be put in or can be put in place, so we start understanding who these individuals are. There are costs associated with these, but they are the risk that we're currently facing right now. Whether someone calls us or we log into a system with maybe something known as a two-factor authentication device, which helps us identify who these people are. We take a look right now, activities going on in the state. We have the state identity and state identity and access management projects going on. We have a pharmacy board that may be trying to take care of the individuals who would be logging onto the system or getting access. But yet the same individuals may access public record systems or public health systems or DMV systems. We take a look at this, see if we can coordinate those identities so that we're sharing identities amongst the two. Not the information, but we can develop a single process which will reduce costs in allowing us to create identities properly. Access control is always a very major concern. When we take a look at this, I notice pieces for providers and others, patients, state individuals, and then educational and public information, ways of presenting this information. We take a look, we can use things like role-based access control to manage and to control this. As it stands right now, again, people call one physician to another and ask for the information, so we're not able to really track who those are unless you have a good personal relationship and you know who that individual is. So through access control mechanisms, we can make sure that the people are who they say they are. They can log in, we can track that. And I think then all this information that we would take a look here is how, for myself and DHS, we would develop a security management plan around this information. There'll still be some with paper, there'll still be some with electronic means, but we would develop a plan that would address the risks. The largest part is we are never going to be perfect. You are always going to have risks. We got up this morning, we came to work, and on my way I drove. I could have been hit by a car, but that's a risk I take in order to get to work. And we do the same with information protection. There are risks. If we want to reduce the risks, we have higher costs associated with it. We could put greater controls around it. And I know that we can do this in order to protect the information. I thank you for allowing me to present to the committee and answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Patrick Bratz, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Board of Dentistry. The Oregon Board of Dentistry is supportive of Senate Bill 355, which will require the Oregon State Board of Pharmacy to establish an electronic prescription drug monitoring program. I think you've heard this morning that diversion of controlled substances is a serious problem in this state and in our country. And only a small number of patients and healthcare providers may be involved, but the consequences of illegal diversion are significant to all of us. The continued illegal diversion of prescription drugs can cause increased costs of healthcare for all citizens, as well as significant treatment and enforcement costs. Money could be better utilized on other health care programs. If a program like this were in place in Oregon, it would obviously help our health care providers. The illegal diversion of prescription drugs by those who seek out those drugs would probably not continue, and rather they could help those individuals receive the specialized treatment that they need, which would surely be a benefit to the citizens of Oregon. You've heard that 38 other states have enacted this type of a program. You've heard arguments that if the bill were to pass, the rights of privacy of some individuals may be at risk. The board would argue that with the enactment of this legislation, the continuation of diversion of illegal prescription drugs, the citizens of Oregon will have to pay increased costs for legitimate prescription drugs. drugs, and in some cases, this could cause some prescription drugs to be in short supply, and you heard that again today. The rights of all Oregonians who have legitimate needs for legal prescription drugs outweigh the limited privacy concerns that some have expressed. The electronic prescription drug monitoring program developed by Senate Bill 355 appears to be sound and thoughtful. I understand there are going to be some amendments added to it, which I think sound good to the program. The board looks forward to being a part of the advisory commission and helping with the development of the rules and the policies that will govern the prescription program here. We urge you to allow Oregon to continue to not continue to be an island while more and more states adopt the prescription drug monitoring program and miss this opportunity for the federal grant program as well as the future funding of it. So we urge you to pass this bill with amendments as necessary, and I'm happy to answer any questions on behalf of the committee.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have a couple of individuals that have driven long ways. Well, I may miss some that have driven a long way. Rob Beauvais, would you come up, please? Blake Rice.
Hello.
And Harry Reinhardt.
Good morning, Senator Morissette and Senators. My name is Harry Reinhardt. I'm a member of the Oregon Pain Commission, and I joined about 3 years ago for the specific purpose of working on this legislation, so I'm happy to be here today. As a practicing physician, I'm a sole practitioner in North Tillamook County. We have a community health center, as like Dr. Peterson does in Clatsop County. We care for about 2,000 patients, a quarter of whom are not able to pay more than $5 at most for their medical care. So we're one of the Oregon safety net clinics. And without this clinic, many people would not be getting their care. I'm also one of even though there are nearly 5,000 Oregon physicians, I'm one of a small handful that if you call and ask if you can be treated for pain, you will be told that, yes, you can be treated for pain there. So we have, as I see it, we have three problems. And as a doctor, I have three stories for you. So the first problem seems to be one of what we call opiophobia, which is a fear to prescribe. And the story I have is about a Vietnam vet who came to me several years ago. And as a 19-year-old Marine landed on a beach in Vietnam, stepped on a satchel charge, blew off the bottom of both of his feet, medial aspect of both legs and one testicle. He awoke on a Navy hospital ship, and eventually spent a year in a naval hospital. When he was released, even though he was a professional artist and is now highly acclaimed, he was unable to receive treatment in Oregon for his painful condition. And he eventually, in attempting to get treatment, resulted in forging a prescription, was caught, and spent a year in a federal penitentiary. So this is how we treat our vets, and it's still a problem. This is the February issue of VFW, and the lead article is about chronic pain, and we're going to have a lot more. The second problem we have, I think, is evidenced by a story of an elderly couple who came to me. They were well-educated. They were both medically retired. They were well-dressed. They drove a Mercedes. And they had records, at least partial records, and they had Social Security documentation of injuries. And we treated them for some time, and as time went on, we had a little more and more trouble getting documentation. And when we really got honing in on them, they stopped coming. And it's clear in retrospect that I was being scammed by them. They were, we were treating them for chronic pain with narcotics, and they were probably diverting them. Now, the people who divert are different than people with addictions. People with addictions are not too hard to find and to discover. But the people who divert are criminals, and they are very, very difficult. They never complain about the amount of medication that's given them. They're always happy to get something. And these are the people who, with this bill, we would stop in their tracks. The third story has to do with myself. As a physician, a fourth-generation Oregon physician whose great-grandmother, grandfather, both parents were physicians and treated people with chronic pain issues all their life, it was not a problem for me. And I was seeing over 300 chronic pain patients in my practice because other physicians in our county and in surrounding counties are extremely reluctant to do so because of fear of prescribing for people who are addicts or who are diverting. Therefore, having this large number of people, about 4 years ago, local law enforcement began reporting me to our Board of Medical Examiners. And when they were done, it was a total of 9 cases. I had to defend myself against those charges, and they were all decided on my behalf. But this took hundreds of hours away from my practice. As a result of that, my wife and I have set up some very complicated, expensive trusts to protect us, because if I were to commit malpractice, I've got great insurance. But if I'm accused of some criminal behavior, there's no insurance whatsoever. You can lose your entire life savings, your pension, your home, as you probably know. So it's, you know, I do not blame my colleagues for being very reluctant to prescribe for patients with chronic pain. It is extremely risky. This bill would reduce some of that risk. And there's one other thing quickly I wanted to mention. I think there's a misconception about having to do with patient confidentiality and consent. If I see somebody with diabetes, I have a doctor-patient relationship. There's no way they're going to be selling their insulin or knocking over the local 7-Eleven so they can buy more of it. But if I have somebody who's for whom I'm prescribing Schedule 2 drugs or Schedule 3 drugs, I have a responsibility to society, and I call this a compact. And I tell my patients that it's no longer just you and me. We now have society in the mix. And therefore, what you do is going to be carefully monitored. They all accept that. In fact, a few years ago, I surveyed my patients, and I asked them if they would sign a statement that said if I suspected them of any criminal activity, would they mind if I contacted the police? Every single one, except maybe one whom I kind of suspected anyway, said fine, and they signed it. So getting a patient consent to buy into this program for legitimate patients who have such a great deal of difficulty getting treated now for chronic painful issues, I think is going to be one of the easiest parts of this whole plan. That's all I have, and thank you very much for the opportunity to be here.
Thank you very much, Harry.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have a question, yes. Please. Exactly. I wonder if you'd just clarify for me the anecdotal that you mentioned about the veteran. In his case, was he unable to get medicine because of the reluctance to prescribe? Or exactly why was he in a situation that he had to turn to illegal methods to get drugs?
Well, I can tell you exactly, because, in fact, while he was seeing me, and he was from Portland, and I said, why are you seeing me? Why are you coming clear down to Wheeler, Oregon? And he said, well, we have a family beach home here, and it's just easier for me when I'm down here to see you. Well, that was a little iffy, but it made sense. So I said, well, that's fine, because you have your wounds, and you have documentation from the Mattigan Army Medical Center Pain Clinic, but you have this problem. So I will see you and treat you. But at some point in time, we're going to have to get a consultation through the VA hospital in Portland from their pain clinic, because that was a requirement at the time, that there be a specialist look at all of us family docs who are treating chronic pain, look over our shoulders, so to speak. So this was not easy. And finally, after a year and a half, I insisted he had to go to the VA. So he did. And it turned out that he was seeing a VA physician, a primary care provider, and me at the same time. Now, his needs for his pain were several hundred milligrams of morphine a day. And with that, he was highly functional. He was working, exhibiting. From the VA in Portland, he was getting 2 5-milligram Percocet a day. And when the prescriber there found out that he was seeing another physician, she fired him. I subsequently got a call from the head of the pain management program apologizing for her action and stating that they would find this person a prescriber within the VA system, which is where he should have been. He should not have had to pay for all of his medications all these years. He should never have gone to prison. He should have been taken care of.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Chairman Morissette, committee members. My name is Blake Rice. I'm from rural Oregon, Axie Riddle, Senator Cruz's area. I drove up this morning and braved the ice to come here because I think this is a very important endeavor. I've actually been involved with trying to get this through for more than 10 years. As a rural pharmacist, I have seen firsthand the misuse and abuse of prescription medications by virtually anybody you might think of, the wealthy, the poor, the whole gamut of society. And in addition to the medical aspect of abuse, there's a tremendous cost to the state. Douglas County is up there per capita costs for medications for whether it's Medicaid patients, private pay patients. There's a lot of money being spent on these drugs. The industry that's been created by the diversion of medications is huge. The street value of some of the drugs is enormous. $5-$10 a tablet creates a whole industry. That's why people would divert those. As the previous speaker mentioned, people do that as a living, and they drive really nice cars. When a legitimate patient comes to my pharmacy, most of the time, because it's rural Oregon, you know most of the folks. Well, a lot of times you get those, oh, I'm visiting my Aunt Sally over here, and I have this new prescription, and so you kind of have to weigh, is that person really visiting Aunt Sally, or is this their stop on I-5 to get a prescription filled? Right now, without calling the prescriber or calling pharmacies around to see if they've gotten prescriptions filled like that, I have no way to know that. So there's that skepticism, and there's a lot of pharmacists that are more skeptical than I am. If you just present with one, you know, you're labeled right away. You're a seeker. Get out of here. I don't want to see you. And that's sad, because we have a significant number of chronic pain patients that are legitimately trying to get treated adequately. A prescription monitoring program would help alleviate a lot of that paranoia about filling those prescriptions. It's been done successfully in 38 other states. We're not breaking new ground. I think we can benefit from all the taking the best of all the programs around the country, and I think the bill addresses a lot of that. There's only a few vendors available that make software that do all those secure things and monitor the data, blind the data so that, you know, patient confidentiality is maintained. So I think some of the fears about a breach are a little bit overstated, since the fact that I'm calling now other pharmacies, that's a lot less secure than this system would be. Oregon's kind of an island here, and I think we do see all those patients traveling from California, Nevada, Idaho, that have programs. They know they're going to get tracked, come here because they know they're not. There's no way to check. Use of medications, all these medications, whether it's the benzodiazepines, which were brought up earlier, runs the gamut of not just misuse, but it's also used in conjunction with some illegal substances to mask some of the side effects, so they're less they don't visibly look that impaired. They don't have the constricted pupils, or they don't have the real dilated pupils. You can take prescription medications to change the appearance. A monitoring program will help all practitioners, whether you're a physician or a pharmacist, maintain not only that you have a patient relationship, but also a legitimate patient relationship, so that you're not worried about the guy dropping in off I-5 saying, "Oh, I'm here visiting Aunt Sally. I've got this oxycodone prescription." So I would urge that my support for the bill, and you, that you pass the bill. Certainly there's some tweaking that has to be done, but since we're not breaking new ground, we can take the best of other programs and make it a very viable program in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Mr. Bovet.
Mr. Chair, Senator, my name is Rob Bovet. I'm Lincoln County District Attorney, but I'm here wearing my hat as Chair of the Oregon Meth Task Force and President of the Oregon Alliance for Drug Endangered Children. We strongly support this bill. I have some written testimony, but I'm not going to cover any of that unless you want me to. I just have two real quick points, and then I'll move on to the back row again. One technical and one policy. While I may disagree with much of what you've heard in terms of legal analysis from Mr. Apgar, I really don't have a problem making technical improvements to this bill, support all three of DHS's proposals, have no problem adding a consumer to the list. Mr. Apgar mentioned that we had added DHS addictions, but we didn't add pain commission. Actually, we did. We added pain commission to the board. Wouldn't have a problem, and I forget his last name, adding Kyle from DHS. HSIT, I think he'd be good to have on the board as well. So I don't have a problem with any of those types of amendments. My policy level comment is just this. When it comes to drug policy, in some ways Oregon has been ahead of the curve, and in some ways we've been behind the curve. It is all about risk. It's the risk of potential breaches, patient confidentiality. On the other hand, it's the risk of doing what we're currently doing now, which is feeding into an epidemic of prescription drug abuse. And we have a proven tool that works. It's just a tool, one tool of many tools we need to address this issue from a prevention standpoint. And when we engage in this risk analysis, it's curious to me that Oregon has been so proactive, sometimes leading the nation. Sometimes when we look at the map of things we've done in the past, such as addressing the meth epidemic and meth labs and a variety of things, drug courts, for example, this map was all white. We were the first ones to do things proactively. We're really late to this game. This needs to happen this session. We need to get ahead of this one to the extent we can at this point in time. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have from my written testimony or anything that has come up, have at me. But thank you for allowing me to testify.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yes, Senator Berger.
I'd just like to make a comment that Rob Bovet has been a tremendous asset in Lincoln County and to the state of Oregon for the continuous work that he's done on drug prevention, drug addiction, trying to help society understand the way to handle it, and it's a pleasure for me to see him today.
Not to mention emergency management, the fisheries, the power generators off the Oregon coast. He's a Renaissance man.
Mr. Chair, we'll talk about that later.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Andrea Meyer, would you come up, please? And Gail Meyer.
How are we doing?
I apologize. We're not going to be able to hear everybody today. We're going to be out of time in about 7 minutes, so I am sorry.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon, here in opposition to Senate Bill 355. I am passing out written testimony. I am not reading my testimony to you. I do want to highlight some very important factors of this specific bill. I know many of you heard me before, but hopefully we can talk about some specifics. Yeah. I appreciate the intentions of many around this bill. For ACLU, the issue becomes you start weighing the risks, particularly to consumers and law-abiding folks, and the benefits to some. Senate Bill 355 is much different than Senate Bill 34 last session. And the first major difference is that last session, the bill was limited to Schedules 2, 3, and 4 of controlled substances. This bill is not limited in any manner. It authorizes the board of pharmacy, quote, to establish, maintain, and operate an electronic system to monitor and report drugs of concern with a documented potential for abuse that are dispensed by prescription. This exclusive authority is given to the board. The advisory commission that's being created has no authority related to this or any other part of this law. It would not only cover a wide range of controlled substances, but non-controlled substances. And depending on the future, who is running the board, the issue could become very politicized. In 2007, related to Senate Bill 34, the proponents testified that they anticipated 2 to 5 million or more prescriptions a year, 2 to 5 million prescriptions a year or more under that limited proposal. This broader scope would likely suggest it will be a much larger number.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I could, just so you'll know, in our discussion, we realize that was a mistake, and we will be specific as to Schedule 2, 3, and 4 in the bill.
Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz, that's fine. I appreciate that. That's important, but I was just going to mention that some of the most frequently prescribed drugs are already included under the old law and would be this, and that would include any codeine-based product, Xanax for anxiety, Ambien for sleep, and Ritalin, which means we will be databasing children in this state. And depending on how many drugs and the frequency, because some of these drugs are broadly described that are under Schedules 2, 3, and 4, it becomes a very important question of who will not be at some point in this database. It really does, despite the intentions of deterrence, turn all of us law-abiding folks into potential drug seekers. And the government intrusion and the use of technology is often intended well-meaning, but it's either to help us to deter crime or find people breaking rules. But it is a government intrusion that erodes our privacy. Now, despite the testimony you've heard today, this program is unproven. In December 2008, I attended, and others on this committee attended, a conference put on by the Pain Commission and the Board of Pharmacy, and the two keynote speakers said there's very little research available to guide this program. There's no outcome evaluation of the Harold Rogers grant. If administered improperly, it undermines pain management and proper prescribing. The Virginia administrator said that the data has not been used to advocate for more treatment, and there's no data to show that these programs have improved access to care or drug treatment. The bottom line is this program has been advanced by the federal government, and the grant comes from the Department of Justice, the law enforcement arm of the government, not the Department of Health and Human Services. No one knows how this program will truly work, and Oregonians should not be joining a program that has not been found to be effective. There is no protective for confidentiality. You have heard a lot of testimony already regarding this and the types of security breaches. I want to briefly note that in the first 36 days of 2009, there have been 36 breaches, and three have occurred in Oregon: University of Oregon, Southwestern Oregon Community College, and most recently, the Coos Bay Department of Human Services. The healthcare industry and governments are not immune from security breaches, and in the past 4 months, 53 breaches, which is well over 50%, have either been healthcare or government entities. My testimony includes the list, but I simply want to note that it includes the Oregon Health and Sciences University, December of last year, and the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Portland. Just because it's not happened to the pharmacy database should give us no comfort. The response to our privacy and security concerns over the last few years have not adequately been addressed. For many years, the legislation and the proponents have argued that the $300,000 federal grant for a two-year period would be sufficient. And even the legislative fiscal folks 2 years ago said that that's not a clearly articulated plan and there's not an associated budget. And it is well beyond uncertain what the cost would be. Now, Washington State estimated 2.1 for a two-year program, and they noted that the Harold Rogers grant would not be appropriate. When they passed it a year ago, they allocated $1 million, and as you've heard from at least one person, but not from everyone, this program has been suspended as of the beginning of this year. Washington State is not participating in this. We are not an island amongst ourselves. They have a budget crisis. They chose to suspend the program. Briefly, the board intends to have a contract with a private vendor. This raises concerns to us because you have very limited money tied to this, and that will go to the private sector, which has a profit margin. It also expands the scope of people and vendors and their employees to which the board or anyone has no direct accountability to. There is new access. You've heard a lot of testimony. Look, this information is already out there, so don't worry. This isn't really creating any new access. It's just formulating into a database, which with all due respect, I don't believe that's true. You have not heard about state government access before, and that, in fact, the government will be running this. But I want to talk a bit about the law enforcement and some language in this legislation. Section 3.2.I gives the board authority for, quote, developing and maintaining effective evaluation and referral mechanisms to evaluate and refer appropriate individuals to medical care, addiction treatment, or law enforcement. Recently, the board wrote that one of the four reasons for this database is to, I quote, to recognize and identify Oregonians who are engaged in blatant doctor shopping or pharmacy hopping that is evident in the internal program audits. One goal appears to give the board and authorized agencies the authority to intervene through law enforcement and potentially contacting law enforcement through medications. Sorry, I feel like I'm maybe distracting you all. But let me continue. I think that this factor in this legislation and the proponents' scope of their authority should raise alarm bells. And the six, you've seen the maps of a number of states that have this program. The program is not the same in every state. Six of them, including some of the largest programs, operate their programs through law enforcement: California, New York, Pennsylvania, Texas, Hawaii, and Oklahoma. The information through the National Alliance for Model State Drug Laws, which is the entity that kind of helps run and provides guidance to states to do this, their information through September 2006 shows that in Idaho, 70% of the requests for law enforcement, Illinois, 50%, Indiana and Pennsylvania, all, Massachusetts, 61%, Mississippi, 50%, Oklahoma, 60%. It's just important to note that while the intentions in Oregon have always been or have been altered to more specifically and try to say they're not law enforcement, this program across the country is intended as a tool for law enforcement. Now, I want to address one of the big issues that's not been touched on, which is consumer rights and remedies and the specific language in this bill. There is not only, you've heard, no consent required, there is no notice in this law, if you pass it, that would inform anyone, I have no right to know that the prescription I'm getting is going to be data-based. People should clearly be informed, and it needs to happen by the doctor at the time of prescribing so the person can have the conversation with the doctor. There may be many who will not want to be in a government-run database and would ask for an alternative drug, not because they're drug seekers, because they don't want to be in a government database. But if you wait to give that information to the consumer at the pharmacy level, they will not be able to communicate with their doctor and make a knowing, willful choice based on their own privacy concerns of legitimate concerns. The broad access to the database It's very large. Section 528A allows a practitioner or pharmacist to receive a report if they are, quote, evaluating the need for or providing medical or pharmaceutical treatment to a person for whom the practitioner or pharmacist anticipates providing, is providing, or has provided care. In other words, if a provider or pharmacist anticipates medical treatment or the patient is a customer, they can get a report. That means that a pharmacy can run a report on every single customer they have. There is no tie to not only receiving the drug that is on the database. There's no tie that they receive from their doctor any kind of drugs. They might be appearing to the doctor or the pharmacy for a completely unrelated situation, and this gives broad authority to the doctor in anticipation of that patient or the pharmacist in serving that client to run a report. Wrongly identified. There is a need, as you know, for critical life-saving medicine or for important pain medicines. But if the pharmacist runs a report and it raises a red flag, the pharmacist can choose not to fill it. The only provision in this is that if the reporting system is down, that's when a pharmacist, if they otherwise would fill it, must. But if they get something fishy, they do not need to fill it. And if it's after hours or the weekend, and neither the doctor is available for discussion, or the board or the entity operating this is available to clarify, the person may go without important medications. The Virginia administrator in the December conference said they run their office 9 to 5 Monday through Friday. That means ER docs and pharmacies on the weekends and evenings have no access to seek clarity with a mismatch. We're not using Social Security numbers. There is no unique identifier. You're going to have mismatches. So, you know, what are we going to do when there's a mix-up in that? You heard earlier testimony that the highest need from some ER doctors is on those evening and weekends when folks show up. But if there's a mismatch, a person may be denied who otherwise should be permitted. Multnomah County experts are developing an electronic-based court filing system, and they've talked about the needs for unique identifiers such as Social Security number, because we have problems with person matching. Since your legislation excludes that, how many mismatch errors will be acceptable in this system? And that, you know, will turn Oregonians who are actually law-abiding to potentially feeling like criminals if there's a mismatch. There is no right to get a report by the consumer, and no right for corrections. And let me explain, because the bill is not clear on that. The providers and pharmacists will have 24/7 access with unlimited frequency to run a report. On Sections 52C, the consumer can only get it once every 6 months. The board can take up to 10 days to give the information. The law doesn't define what information the consumer is entitled to see. Will it be their prescription history? Will it be who has requested a report on them? It may be a complete or limited record. It's up to the board. The law is silent. There is no guarantee provided of meaningful information, and it also provides in the statute that a person may request the board to correct errors. Now, you don't need legal authority to give someone the power to call up an state agency and request an error be fixed. It doesn't require the board to take action. The law doesn't have a time requirement. It does not have an appeal process if the board either refuses to take timely action or any action. There's no meaningful due process rights, and there's no consumer oversight. What if the information released to the provider or the pharmacist with a patient who does not have a relationship with those providers? What if the database releases the wrong information about someone? How will they ever know? The only meaningful oversight is notification to the consumer every time a report is requested. Only I will know if Dr. A is my doctor or the pharmacist X is my pharmacy. Also, the data is allowed to be retained by the Board of Pharmacy for up to 3 years. That will mean millions and millions of data. Briefly, I need to talk about the immunity provision. You've heard some testimony about the need to have the safeguards, the protections up front. And the only way you do that, a big way you do that, is that there's a hammer at the other end if you fail to do that. This is one of the broadest immunity provisions I've seen possible. It protects the board, it protects the pharmacist, and it protects the providers, but not the consumer. Section 32F, the board gives exclusive authority to itself to assess any civil penalties for failing to report or for wrongful disclosure of data. Well, what if the board does that? Will it fine itself? I mean, the attorney general, at a minimum, must be given authority on behalf of consumers, who also should have private rights of actions for meaningful remedy if the board or others disclose. The language really actually provides full immunity. It states, a pharmacy or a person authorized under Section 5 to obtain or use information from the program is immune from civil liability arising out of the reporting or release of the information if the pharmacy or person reports, obtains, or uses the data in good faith. So if the pharmacy or provider obtains the data in good faith or uses the data in good faith, either one, but not necessarily both, they are immune if they are reckless, if they are negligent, or even if they intentionally release the data. And even if there was not to be immunity for intentional action, persons have no rights and no remedies for very real injuries that can be suffered. There's no provision that the consumer will ever know that there's been a wrongful release, and the board may assess civil penalty but has no obligation to inform of the misuse or do that. There really is no separate remedy to make the consumer whole. Immunity provided, also there's immunity provided if the information is negligently intentionally released to another state that receives the information. Under Section 52EE, and I need to note because I believe these sections are quite misnumbered at some point along the way, it's on page 3, lines 30 to 32. The board is authorized to share the database with other states if the board determines security and privacy standards are equivalent to ours. This provision is premature. We urge you not to move forward with it. Oregon doesn't even have the systems in place, and they should spend the first few years, if you move forward, ensuring that their technology safety systems are sound before they're prepared to evaluate another state's. They can come back to the legislature for that authority. Cost is a civil liberties issue, and the database authorized the state to give power the authority to collect and share personal information, and it's essential that sufficient funds be allocated to ensure the very best system, and the system be updated with state-of-the-art technology. And often the best technology is the most expensive. If Oregon moves forward, you need to put the significant resources on an ongoing basis. You can build a database, but Oregonians don't want that. They want full protections. Other states have done this. Alabama, which has a more limited program, and only a weekly collection, so it's similar to Oregon's plan, was fully operational in 2006. It collects 9 to 10 million prescriptions a year, and its startup was 1.15 million. In 2008, the state appropriated in Alabama another over $500,000 for the program. Kentucky startup costs, and I want to be clear because it was their startup costs in 2005, which wasn't long ago, and it was before they put an additional $5 million into additional enhancement. Their startup was $1.4 million. I can't assume that costs have gone down. Costs have only gone up when it talks about state-of-the-art technology. In conclusion, this plan is too flawed. The proposal does not have the necessary safeguards. It's written to assist pharmacists and providers, but not to meaningfully protect consumers, and we urge you not to move forward. Thank you.
We are going to carry this over till Wednesday after we hear this testimony, and we will go back, and Kyle Miller was making faces back there, so he will have an opportunity to come up and respond.
Kyle in the audience. You mean Rob Bovet or someone else?
No.
Chair Morris,
Mr. Miller, who made the presentation earlier.
Mr. Chair, may I ask Andrea a question very quickly?
Sure.
Andrea, do you believe there is a perfect bill for our prescription monitoring program?
Chair Morissette, Senator Verger, yes and no. No, there is not a perfect bill, but if the state of Oregon is going to do this, then it needs to be far more perfected than this. There are ways that you can make it better and ways you can make it worse, and ACLU will oppose this bill, but it would certainly not stop at that. We would urge you to put necessary and critical safeguards in place for the benefit of all of us.
follow-up, are those recommendations in your testimony?
Chair Morissette, I've identified all of our concerns. Again, I want to really emphasize the consumer and the immunity provisions, lack of any private right of action, the fact that everyone using and handling this is given no standards. And that includes, with all due respect, the providers, not just the board. Okay. The providers need to have, there needs to be an ability for me to go after or at least seek redress, rather, from a provider or a pharmacy or the board if they misuse, release, or otherwise either negligently, intentionally, or recklessly handle my information.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, my name is Gail Meyer. I'm the legislative representative for the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I will super truncate my comments today in appreciation for the committee staying so long. I've been a criminal defense practitioner for 25 years in Michigan, Oregon, and Washington, and I have had clients who have been addicted to prescription drugs, and I praise the good intentions of those who are the proponents of the bill. What I recognize, however, as a criminal defense practitioner is that this database will create a very tempting roadmap for law enforcement for future prosecutions of some of these individuals. Now, I distinguish in my comments between those who outright commit crimes by forging prescriptions, and I distinguish those individuals from those who seek consultations with physicians, and through the course of their consultations, have no notice and give no consent for the creation of the database. I'll focus my comments specifically on Section 3, Subsection 2, Subsection I. That's on line 27-28. As currently drafted, this bill would delegate to the board the authority to make rules for determining when an individual should be referred to medical care, when an individual should instead be referred for addiction treatment, and when instead an individual should be referred to law enforcement. Those three options vary considerably, with huge consequences to the individual. It should not be made on an ad hoc basis. It should not be made on a haphazard basis. And I would suggest that it would be up to this committee and the legislature to create and identify the standards by which that variance should be recognized and implemented. There's no understanding, as currently framed, who makes this determination. Is it just simply an individual at a pharmacy that should make the determination for referral to law enforcement? Should it be done by committee? Is there a special committee? Should it be done by the board? Should the prescriber be first consulted before there's a referral? In addition to that, there's no standards for determining when it would be appropriate to go to medical care or refer instead to addiction treatment or to law enforcement. My concerns arise in addition to not just the language here, but when I look at the proposed composition of the advisory board. As currently framed, the advisory board would consist primarily of medical associations and licensing boards, but then also I note the Oregon State Police. In addition to not having a consumer advocate on the board, there would be no representative from the criminal defense community, and I would urge this committee, please, to consider that seriously. I think there needs to be a balance between the investigative and punitive and law enforcement focus, as well as those with criminal defense, who would be mindful of the consequences of a porous sharing of information between the database and members of law enforcement. And finally, also, when it comes to law enforcement seeking access affirmatively on its initiative to the database, I would suggest that as currently framed, the statute is not very clear as to the actual process or procedure or standards by which law enforcement can gain access. In Section 5, Subsection 2AC, it says that law enforcement can have access pursuant to a valid court order. That term is vague and lacks specificity in the law. We don't know what that means. Is it based on probable cause? Is it based on reasonable suspicion? Do they merely need to establish good cause shown, or that it would be relevant to an ongoing investigation? Those are huge variances in standards, and I think they should be spelled out. And secondly, it's unclear what kind of a proceeding it would be. If law enforcement were to go to a court to get a court order, the question is, would it be an ex parte proceeding where law enforcement simply goes,
similar to securing a search warrant, where they would simply go to a court and say, we have an ongoing investigation, we'd like to get into the database, or must there be notice provided at least to the prescriber that this information is being sought? And in our opinion, we would also like to see notice being provided to the patient so that they're also on notice that the information is being received.
Wouldn't probable cause be sufficient?
Probable cause would be an ideal standard, yes. But it's not spelled out in the statute, and I would encourage the committee to do that.
Okay. A court order would be you would need probable cause, wouldn't you?
Court orders can be issued on lesser standards. And so it would be, I think as currently phrased, just simply saying valid court order, it would leave the court in a quagmire to know what the legislature intended. So I do believe that probable cause would be the ideal standard.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I'm sorry that we have run out of time, and we're going to carry this over for what it's worth to those of you who came today and could not testify. We're going to carry it over till Wednesday and continue the discussion. There have been a lot of good comments, some valid suggestions in opposition to, and I'm hoping that we can move along and make a better bill. If we're going to move this, it would be a better bill. So thank you so much for being here, and we will carry it over until Wednesday at 8 o'clock in this very room. Thank you very much.
Bang your gavel.
I'm not going to bang it yet until everybody leaves. Meeting adjourned. Kathy Hahn.